proceed.
May it please the court. I would like to start by apologizing for an error in my opening brief. In preparation for the argument, I discovered on page 23, I mistakenly cited the Zimmerman case, which is an unpublished per curiam decision and should be stricken from my brief. I apologize for my unintentional error. Now I would like to discuss the due process claim. We are arguing there is a right to due process in rezoning hearings in Wisconsin. The right to due process in hearings affecting property rights is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Due process applies to hearings that affect property rights. Since zoning affects property rights, due process is required in zoning hearings. And the right to due process requires impartial decision makers. In my brief, I've shown that the U.S. Supreme Court and Wisconsin Supreme Courts have held a fair trial in a fair tribunal is a basic requirement of due process. Courts have said that a minimal rudiment of due process is a fair and impartial decision maker. Other due process elements, including the right to cross-examine witnesses, are not rudimentary and can be suspended in rezoning hearings. We are not claiming there should be a right to cross-examine witnesses at a rezoning hearing. We're claiming there is a right to an impartial tribunal, because without an impartial tribunal, there is no hearing. Hearing is defined by the dictionary as an opportunity to be heard, to present one side of a case, or to be generally known or appreciated. An impartial decision maker will not provide someone an opportunity to be known or appreciated. Miller was entitled to a hearing based on Wisconsin Statute 62.23(7)(e)(6) and the Code of the Village of Linden Station, Section 395(17)(e). 62.23(7)(e)(6) states that the Board of Appeals shall fix a reasonable time for the hearing of the appeal and give public notice of it. It doesn't say the Board of Appeals shall fix a reasonable time for an aggrieved party to speak to a brick wall and give public notice of it.
Does the Zoning Board of Appeals have the authority to review the Village Board's decision here? Because as I look at 62.23(7)(e)(7)(b), it talks about the enforcement of an ordinance.
Yes, Your Honor, in point four, I explained why the ZBA has authority to hear the appeal, and I think it falls under 7E4 states that appeals to the Board of Appeals may be taken by any person aggrieved by any officer, department, board, or bureau of the city. And Miller filed the letter of the law and appealed to the Board of Appeals. The ZBA met and voted on his appeal. And the 62.23(7)(e)(4) corresponds to 395(17)(e) of the Village, which says that an appeal to the ZBA may be taken from a decision of any village, officer, department, clerk, building inspector, or other administrative official. So when Miller saw the Village Board make a decision at the August 13, 2020 meeting, he followed 395(17)(e) and appealed to the village officers. He followed the letter of the code and the statute. The interveners claim the ZBA didn't have the right because the Village Board doesn't qualify as an officer, department, clerk, or building inspector. But Chapter 1 of the Code of the Village of Linden Station, which is document 87 in the record, states that officers are, quote, "The term officers shall refer solely to local offices created by state statute," end quote. Since the Village Board is a local office created by state statute, the board qualifies as an officer.
So under your argument, under sub 4,
What's your best argument for why he's a person aggrieved? Because if you're not looking at what the, I mean, you're taking us away from what the Village Board of Appeals power is, which I would think would always be at play, and you're saying, no, we should apply sub 4 by any person aggrieved. So how is that? Who is aggrieved? Is that any person in the village, period?
Anybody with a property interest. And Mr.
Anyone
Miller,
who owns property in the village
it be close aggrieved. Enough that it would fall within, he would lose property value by the change in zoning, by what's coming in.
Okay.
That is generally how these zoning statutes work across the state, that someone who has property that is close enough to the project coming in that he might lose value has standing to challenge zoning decisions.
What about subsection 7E10, which says any person or persons jointly or severally aggrieved by any decision of the Board of Appeals has a right to review that board under certiorari within 30 days. Isn't that where you filed?
That is what I filed under, yes.
Okay, 10.
Because
okay.
The board took the appeal and ruled on it, so
yeah.
Then we filed an action for certiorari within 30 days.
Okay, all right, thank you.
If continuing with this point about the ZBA's jurisdiction for a minute, that if Miller had appealed the board decision straight to court, defendants would have claimed he did not exhaust his remedies because the local ordinances, which mirror the state statutes, tell him to go to the ZBA.
Isn't a writ of certiorari in circuit court? That's not something to the Zoning Board of Appeals.
No, right. No.
Okay,
that's
how you get to the circuit court. Why would you be going to the Board of Appeals? And your answer is you think that we don't look to the power of the Board of Appeals under sub 7B. Instead, we're looking just generally by any person aggrieved under 4.
Under, yes, that's correct.
So we're just supposed to, I'm confused by your argument. I'm confused why we just ignore 7B.
7EB? Is that
7E7B. I'm not following. 7E. I'm not following because it says
7?
That's what gives power to the Zoning Board of Appeals. So how do we just disregard that? And that section says that it's just for the enforcement of this section or any ordinance adopted pursuant thereto.
7E7 concerns area variances, and the Whaleys did not apply for a variance under this section.
No.
They applied for rezoning.
Okay, I'm looking at 7B.
7E?
7E,
7B. I'm sorry, I'm looking at 7E as in elephant, 7B as in boy. So the subsection, the subsection right before you were just looking, which starts out with the phrase, the Board of Appeals shall have the following powers.
Right, and I believe that 7E, 7B goes under 7E7, which they all concern area variances. That's what I would say, and variances are not part of this case. But I also believe that the village is estopped from claiming that Miller did not have, that the ZBA lacked jurisdiction to rule on this because the board's decision was made on August 13th. Miller called about appealing it. He called the village before the 18th. He emailed the village on August 18th and 20th about appealing it. The village made him go to an appeal to the ZBA. It didn't say the ZBA is not going to hear it. They made him go through a zoning procedure that they then claimed was invalid. They made him miss a potential 30-day deadline for appealing the village board decision to court. This is unfair, and the doctrine of estoppel should prevent the ZBA from making this claim. I also believe the procedure complies with the state law, and the ZBA is estopped from claiming it had no jurisdiction. I think if he had taken the village board's decision straight to court, they would have claimed he didn't exhaust administrative remedies, and they would have made him miss all deadlines by bait and switch. But we did name the village board in an amended complaint within 6 months of the village board's decision, which is a time limit allowed for certiorari review under common law. Therefore, this would save Miller's claims if the ZBA lacked jurisdiction, which it shouldn't be allowed to make when he inquired many times how to appeal, and they said come to the ZBA and set up the hearing.
Is there anything in the record that you can refer me to that has a documentation of that, some email or?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Right. The emails are, I have the pages. Hold on.
No, I'm just talking about documentation of what the village board told him to do.
Yes. Okay. His letters to the village board about the appeal are in the record, and I have the page. It's in the record 60.50 and 60:54.
Okay.
Are
thank
his
you.
Emails to the village board about appealing? And the first one on the 18th says, I called the village, and now I'm emailing because I didn't get an answer. And they went ahead, set this up, the hearing at the ZBA. He couldn't force the ZBA to meet. They, at a village board meeting, they said, we're going to pick officers for the ZBA to hear the appeal. So they reconstituted this board that hadn't been active for several years to hear his appeal. He could not force them to do that. They told him to do that.
Thank you.
And took his appeal. If there are no more questions on this point, I'll return to the due process claim. Okay.
Before you do, let me just say, the power of the Board of Appeals is to hear and decide appeals where it's alleged that there's an error of an order, requirement, decision, or determination made by an administrative official in enforcement of this section or any ordinance adopted pursuant thereto. So you're saying the ZBA has jurisdiction to hear this appeal?
Yes, I am.
Because which of those things is it?
It was the phrase that you read about any error in the ordinance.
Error in any order, requirement, decision, or determination.
That's right. Yes. Let's.
And which of those is it?
Okay, you're reading from 63.7E4. Is that right?
I think. Is it 7E7B. Or 7B.
Yeah, 7E7B. So that's a different place than she was reading from. She's reading from subsection 4, you're reading under subsection 7B,
yep.
Which is not what she was reading.
I am reading under 7E7B. I just want to make sure I know which of those things this determination was, the legislative amendment to the zoning ordinance.
Okay, 7E1 says the council which enacts zoning regulations shall by ordinance provide for the appointment of a board of appeals and shall provide that such board of appeals may, in appropriate cases and subject to appropriate conditions, make special exceptions to the term of the ordinance in harmony with its general purpose. I believe that gives the ZBA jurisdiction.
Okay, then just bear with me for a minute and I won't keep you on this too long, but I'm just trying to reconcile it in my mind. 7E, you just read to me, but then go further down to 7B, where it talks about the power of the Board of Appeals, what they have power to do.
Go further up to 7B,
no,
you mean?
No, down. Board of Appeals is E, right? Then
yes.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, right? There's 7A.
Following you
and
there?
7B.
Okay, yes. Okay.
So that's their power. And I would just want to know what power they were invoking to hear this particular issue.
I am arguing that 7A and B and C and D apply to variances and don't apply to this case. because the Whaleys did not seek a variance.
Okay.
I think those all, when it says in 7A in this subdivision, I think that follows under there, and this power comes from the earlier section.
Okay, so B relates only to variances.
That's what I'm arguing.
Okay.
Yes. It's much easier when I have it out. Are there any more questions now that I've got it out in front of me?
Where's the other source of authority? The other source of authority would come from the ordinance. Take a look at that and explain to me your position vis-a-vis the ordinance language.
Okay, under 395.17, is that what you're asking about, the village ordinances?
395.17H1A.
Okay. 395.17E is what I'm saying applies, and that's why the village set up the ZBA and heard the appeal. It says scope of appeals. Appeals to the Zoning Board of Appeals may be taken from a decision of any village office, department, clerk, building inspector, or other administrative official relating to any zoning ordinance by any person aggrieved or affected by that decision. And I'm saying the village board qualifies as an officer under a different provision of the Linden Station Code, which has the definitions of officer, which says it shall refer solely to local offices created by state statute. And the village board is an office created by state statute. So I'm saying that gives the village the authority to hear the appeal in the zoning board. And that is what the village board, that is what the village did with its ZBA and the village board. I will return to the due process claim. Okay. And if the Court of Appeals opinion is upheld, saying there is no right to an impartial decision maker in rezonings, Wisconsin's approach will chill public participation and eviscerate confidence in commissions and courts. People were very upset in this village that the applicant's mother was voting in this case, and in future hearings on other matters, people will likewise become upset if the Court of Appeals opinion stands. Many people spoke about the impropriety of the mother voting. People will resent governments and courts for sanctioning biased decision makers. The effect of this will be to chill public participation in governmental proceedings and instill distrust in governmental bodies and courts. In my brief, I cited several cases from other states that require family members to recuse themselves from voting on family members' requests. There are additional cases mentioned for the same point in the Law Review article by Mark Cortez, which the Marist Court relied on, and I cited in my reply brief.
Counsel, what about Wisconsin Statute 19.59.1A? Did you look at that?
Yes, and the ethics statutes.
Yep.
And how they relate to this.
Yep.
And as I stated in my brief, the fact that there is an ethics statute which Trustee Miller does not appear to violate does not mean her voting on her daughter's request did not deprive Miller of his due process right to an impartial decision maker. Due process concerns are separate and distinct from ethical violations. The circuit court said accurately that simply because there is a statute that absolves the trustee from an ethical violation does not mean there is a corresponding due process violation. The ethics statutes are designed to discover and punish ethical violations and not designed to ensure due process is provided in all hearings in all manners. The Ethics Code authorizes the Attorney General to seek punishment, fines, and imprisonment against officials who act when they have ethical conflicts. It doesn't purport to guarantee due process is met in every hearing in the state. The closest case I can find illustrating this is that of Miller versus Carroll, which was cited by the interveners, where the court said a judge had violated due process by engaging in Facebook contacts with a party, but plaintiff didn't, it noted in dictum that plaintiff did not bring a claim for judicial disqualification pursuant to the ethics statute. This shows that ethics and due process are different. We don't look to the state legislature to tell us what is due process. We look to the courts. It is not their role to determine due process. They're telling us when the AG can go find somebody. So they're distinct here. In the last few minutes, I will discuss whether the rezoning is legislative or quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial. One couple's property is being rezoned here for a specific request to permit a Dollar General store and afford a significant amount of money to interveners. It looks quasi-judicial.
So rezoning is the issue, right?
Yes.
And that is a decision of the administrative officer?
Yes. The office was the village board here who heard the who referred the application to the plan commission. The plan commission made a recommendation, but it wasn't a final decision. Then the village board voted on the plan commission's recommendation, and then Miller appealed the village board's decision to the ZBA.
I'm stuck in the language of the statute. E7E, and then you get to 4, appeals to the Board of Appeals may be taken by any person aggrieved or by any officer, department, board, or bureau of the city affected by any decision of the administrative officer. Is that the section you're going under?
Yes, it
saying
is.
Saying this is a decision of an administrative officer.
That's correct.
An administrative officer makes a legislative act.
I'm not agreeing that it was completely a legislative act,
okay.
But officer includes offices, specifically in the village code ordinances.
Council, if opposing counsel says this was a legislative decision, if we agreed with that, do you still have a due process argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I think due process applies to legislative decisions because property rights are affected. This is not a legislative decision affecting the whole community as in the same way. This is one person's property affecting the neighboring properties. So I don't agree it's legislative, but if it were legislative, I don't think the courts can take away the right guaranteed by the United States Constitution of due process of law.
And that's a pretty remarkable holding. I mean, in some ways, I mean, legislative decisions affect people's rights, property values all the time. I imagine the legislature or even the governor in proposing a budget would find it remarkable that there is a due process right to some sort of impartiality in making a legislative proposal.
Well, this isn't a strictly legislative decision. It's a rezoning. And legislative and rezonings are not legislative in all times, but they are called that because it's simple and easy. But this one affects one is written at the request of one couple's application, and the village board and ZBA are looking at one person's property, one couple's property in relation to the community. They're not making legislation that affects everybody as a whole.
Under my question, though, assuming it's legislative, what's your best authority for the idea that there is a due process right governing a legislative decision or quasi-legislative decision?
And that would be the U.S. and Wisconsin constitutions, where it says that due process applies to decisions affecting property rights. And rezonings affect property rights, especially when they're made and on small individual parcels of land.
So if the legislature or a local community or county passes, some sort of legislation enabling development, say in Milwaukee, near Fiserv Forum. There's a lot of development going on down there. That affects people's property rights. Is there a due process right to every decision with those development decisions?
I think there should always be a right to an impartial decision maker, because that is a rudimentary element of due process, and the court can't suspend due process in legislative proceedings. Due process still applies.
Do you have any authority beyond sort of the generic invocation of the Constitution that would support that proposition you're
advancing? Well, the Maris case is very good in its language, and it specifically mentions quasi-legislative. So the Maris court opinion is good authority for that, along with some federal cases I cited in my brief, and the Guthrie and Tetrick Tech cases cited in the brief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. When a local legislative body votes to amend its zoning ordinance, that vote is a legislative one. As a legislative act, a non-resident who owns no property affected by the amendment has no constitutional basis on which to demand the recusal of one of the local legislators, based on the fact of kinship alone. Were it otherwise, the legislative work in small communities like Linden Station could be ground to a halt by endless recusal demands. That is exactly why Section 19.59 is drafted so carefully to exempt official acts respecting proposed legislation. The Whaleys respectfully request that this court apply its settled precedent to reject Miller's recusal demands and affirm the Village Board's vote to amend its zoning ordinance.
Is it your position that the Zoning Board of Appeals didn't have jurisdiction to hear the matter brought before it?
Yeah, and I apologize if I said the Zoning Board. I thought I said Village Board. So I'm asking that the Village Board's vote, that's the act that's at issue and not the ZBA's review.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you about the ZBA.
Sure.
Okay. And I was concerned about representations that have been made both in the materials filed and today that actually the Village told the petitioners that they had to go before the Zoning Board of Appeals. Is that a fact or fiction?
That I'm not aware of. I mean, so, A, we don't represent the Village here, but B, my understanding is that, yes, they did put together the ZBA okay. and that they did do things that indicated, at least, that that's where the appeal should be taken.
Okay.
I don't know that my position is necessarily that they would have been out of time to challenge the Village Board. So I believe they had 6 months for when a statute doesn't provide, I apologize, I didn't cite a case for this, but generally when a statute doesn't provide a time period for certiorari review.
Yeah, I think you're right under common law, and I think opposing mm-hmm. counsel agrees with that.
Yeah, so I'm not saying this appeal would be necessarily unlawful. I guess our position is that it's just common law certiorari, not the statutory certiorari.
Right.
I'm not sure that it actually affected her position, because she did end up pleading in the Village Board.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're on the topic, I do want to quickly address the authority of the ZBA and the discussion. I think Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Counsel, could you also just address the estoppel argument as a part of your remarks?
Well, as I heard it, the estoppel argument was directed towards what the Village was doing. Again, we're the interveners. I don't know that we're necessarily estopped. So I don't think that there was any harm, because I'm not saying that her appeal couldn't happen. I'm saying because her petition for certiorari review properly, eventually in her amended petition, did properly name the Village Board. So I'm just saying that there really is no effect. I'm not saying that this appeal is unlawful or shouldn't have happened. We're just saying that the ZBA portion of it was inappropriate.
But you're representing... You're not representing the ZBA, and you're not representing the Village. It puts you in kind of a hard position before us then, because we're looking at the actions of those entities. And so
aside from any reliance on what the village did or the ZBA did, how are you going to persuade us that we should leave the decision of the Court of Appeals in place?
Well, both lower court decisions, all of the lower review bodies, so the ZBA, the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, they all were based on, they thought they were reviewing the ZBA or the ZBA thought they had jurisdiction.
Right.
So I don't have a particularly strong feeling about you preserving the lower court decisions. I think you could just, strike them all down and just leave the village board's vote because they're the only ones who did it properly.
Okay, so your position is the village board's vote was correct, and that's the end of the story?
Right, that's the end of the story.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Do you have an opinion, though, on what opposing counsel talked about in terms of the ZBA, with her citing to subsection 4 as the basis for the ZBA to be able to hear this case as opposed to 7E, 7B?
Yes, and this is exactly what I was about to get to, which is that Justice Anne Walsh Bradley is exactly correct that in 395-17, and you go down to H1A, there it says there's nothing really talking about variances in this part of it, this part of the zoning code. And it says, to hear and decide appeals when it is alleged there is an error in any order, requirement, decision, or determination made by an administrative official and denying any permit required by the village's ordinance. But I don't think we have to go down that road to just go here. I think we can just look at what the definition of an administrative official is, and we know that that is going to be different than a legislative official. We know because there is a section in Chapter 62.23, I believe. I apologize. I have to pull it up off my brief. But that does talk about when the village board, it has to make a decision how it's sitting. Is it sitting as a legislative body or is it sitting as an adjudicative body or administrative body? And so when we look at the enabling statute, when it talks about an administrative official, it's talking about, it could be the village board, but only when the village board is sitting as administrative board and not a legislative board.
And so why weren't they sitting as an administrative board here, given that, according to opposing counsel, you're just talking about one property?
Because we have clear case law under Quinn that a vote to amend an ordinance is always legislative. It does not matter how many people are involved, how big the parcel of land is. And I want to bring up an example. I think Justice Hagedorn was getting to this point, but, I mean, a big part of this budget will be a discussion about the Brewers. That's just one entity, really just one parcel of land, and they're going to have to make a decision, and it could be a standalone bill where it just says, this is how much money we're giving, there will be some contracting going on, but it's just one entity, it's just one piece of property that the legislature is dealing with. And the legislative character that's being delegated from the legislature or the state legislator down to local zoning, to local villages, local cities, local municipalities, that's the same character. There is no difference. So to the extent that it's going to be legislative when this state legislator takes action on someone like the Brewers, the same extent when local legislators take action on what seems like just one property, it's still legislative. And that's what Quinn says.
Well, that doesn't mean that there's no due process right. I look at Morris versus the city of Cedarburg. That was one property where there was a hearing. The person lost their non-conforming use. But before the hearing, the chairman of the hearing said, oh, well, this property is a loophole that needs to be closed. And that was taken as showing a bias. So we reversed that and sent it back down again for another hearing without that person participating. So if we follow Morris, why don't we reverse what was done here by the village and send it back down for another hearing before the village where the mother is not participating?
So Maris is about a non-conforming use.
Right, which is part of the zoning.
It is part of zoning, yeah, but it is an adjudicative part of zoning. And this is the clear line I was trying to draw in my brief, is that there is a line between... So when we look at what a non-conforming use is, there are specific standards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the court's going to say... You can go ahead. Sorry, did you...
I was the same thing. I'm just listening to what you're saying.
So when you look, there are specific standards, and they're pretty specific. I mean, it's like a 50%, too much change. There's specific factors that the court has to sit, or sorry, not the court, but whatever administrative official at the local level, they're going to have to sit and they're going to have to look at the facts of the specific property and apply it to those specific standards. And a zoning amendment doesn't have those same type of limitations. There's not specific standards except for it needs to be consistent with. It needs to be, for the general welfare. It needs to be for the health, safety of the community. Those, I think, we have always considered to be legislative policy choices. I mean, they're very broad. And so that's where I'm drawing the line between something in Marist, which I would call administrative, and what we have here, which is a zoning amendment.
Okay.
And that is going to be legislative.
Do you have a case that says zoning amendments are always legislative, even when what we're doing here is about zoning, because you just have one property?
Yes.
What should I look at?
Yeah, so the case is Quinn.
Okay.
Quinn versus Town of Dodgeville.
Yeah.
And then we also have the cases that they're citing in there. So I'm just going to quote directly from Quinn. Zoning is legislative action, and rezoning by amending the ordinance is equally legislative. Skipping some lines here. The action does not lose its legislative character simply because the number of people affected or the size of the land is small. We disagree with the other authorities who have found the contrary. An ordinance amendment is legislation since it changes the ordinance but does not execute or implement its provisions. I don't know that you could really get any more square than that, so that's what I'm going to rely on is Quinn, and I don't see a good justification for overruling Quinn here. I think it's a bright-line rule. I think why we do bright-line rules in local government is because, we can be frank, that local governments aren't always the most sophisticated officials. I mean, their public service is greatly appreciated, but they're not all lawyers. They're not all living through these statutes and trying to figure out this type of distinctions. And so I think the bright line rule is really important because even just look at this case. I mean, if we were talking about, okay, well, maybe there was two properties but only one owner. Okay, now is that legislative? Is that adjudicative? Does the ZBA get to review it or not? I mean, that's going to be confusing all the way up and down. And so I think this bright line rule was a good policy, or not a policy choice, but just a good choice, a common law choice by this court, and I think the court should continue to adhere to it.
Well, and if it's legislative, you say there's no due process right in legislation that affects property?
That's correct. I'm saying that there is no, and because if it's legislative, I mean, consider what legislators do all the time. They say, I'm running because I'm going to oppose this legislation, or I even look at local governments. They do this all the time. I don't want this development to happen. I am running. I am going to oppose, you know, the zoning change. I don't think that's improper. That's precisely what they run on. So I agree that there is no impartiality requirements when it comes to legislative decisions. I think that's exactly what they run on.
Does that matter, though, that we elect our legislators, but we don't elect our mothers that get to sit on?
Fair enough. Well, some people do vote for their mother to run.
Well, I hope so.
Can we go back to the statute? Can we go back to 6223-7E-7B?
Sure.
And what I understand Attorney Henry saying is this whole subsection, and by subsection I mean the 7E7 part, that does not apply in this case because 7A talks about variances, and I'll note that F also talks about variances. We're not talking about a variance here, so therefore 7E7B wouldn't apply.
I mean, I've read that as she was talking about it. I don't see that. I mean, it looks like they're just defining what an area of variance will mean in that subsection. It doesn't say this subsection is about area variances. I don't need that provision, though, quite frankly. I mean, even if you go to, it is, I believe, 6 sub 4, or sorry.
E.
Yes, E sub 4.
Yeah.
Yes, 6. It still talks about an administrative officer, and this is what I was getting to earlier, is that there are other provisions that do distinguish between when a board is sitting as an administrative board and when it is sitting as a legislative board. And I think they chose that word administrative very, very carefully.
It says administrative officer. Is a board an administrative officer?
No.
I mean, my position is... I think council argues that a board is. How do we resolve that issue?
I don't have a particular opinion on that because I think the administrative qualifier is what defeats it. But as far as I don't read officer to mean board, and I apologize if there's a definition of officer here that I didn't see. I apologize. But I don't have a strong position other than I know that the qualifier administrative is what is determinative here.
Your preference, though, is that... Well, in terms of deciding this case, you give us all kinds of choices. How would you like us to, if you had your platinum standard here, what would you want us to hold here?
I mean, my preference is, I think for the sake of purity, it would be best to hold that this, that someone who doesn't have property that's actually affected by the zoning ordinance doesn't have a freestanding constitutional right. I think the statutes do give them a right to a hearing, and I think that's a fine policy choice. But it doesn't. But I don't think the Constitution comes into effect because the Constitution is very clear in its text. It says life, liberty, or property. Yes, there's property interests, but it is not because of this decision. This is just changing one property in sort of the universe of things that could be developed. But it's not saying, oh, well, we're definitely putting... something's going to go there and it's going to hurt property taxes or it's going to hurt property values or it's going to... Those would be later decisions. We don't know necessarily what's going to go there. You'll have to get a building permit. I think there are going to be several other permitting processes. And Miller will have an opportunity to stand on his interest regarding, I guess, downstream effects, these market effects that might change the value of his store or to his rental properties. But my position is here that those interests aren't implicated by this decision, which is just to change the zoning, basically the color of the zoning on the map. Yes, Mrs. Bradley.
I find this case bothersome for several reasons. One is that we're dealing with a lot of authority of municipal entities but don't have any input from those municipal entities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to make a mistake on this one. Not that we ever make a mistake,
yes.
But certainly don't here because of the implications
right.
Throughout the state. So that causes me concern. Let me also say it causes me concern in a big picture analysis about having a mother who lives with someone who arguably is affected. Now, I have to take a lot of the givens that you present. I have to take a given based on Quinn that this is legislative, not like Morris, quasi-legislative maybe, right? Because once I take that as a given, then it's easy to repeat the mantra of there's no due process, right? So I have those concerns. For instance, can someone, if he or she were a member of the of the village board, sit on their own case? Let's say everything else is the same, except the board member wasn't the mother who's living with Miller, but Miller himself. Does that make any difference? Any
bias? Or do I laugh? Because of course there's bias. You know, I mean, but any due process considerations if he sat himself?
No, and this is why I'm going to turn to this court's cases in Miller and County of Dane, which is we presume that they're acting with honesty and integrity. I get it that it can be uncomfortable to say that, you know, I'm going to sit on my own case, but I think at some level we have to that presumption prevails because there is no actual evidence that this individual can't be mindful of the community's concerns or, you know, sit through that hearing and say, oh, you know, now I understand, so I'd like to not, you know, I'll vote against my hearing. So I'm going to look at Miller v. Carroll and the recent decision in County of Dane to say there's got to be something else. There's got to be some statement or some action. We can't just presume that they are going to be biased. So
yes, I understand that in terms of a record. Mm-hmm. But the law has to make sense. And do you think it would make sense to anyone or to most people in Linden Station to say, yes, even though Mr. Miller thinks that this rezoning is going to take away his livelihood, he can sit and decide the issue. Does that make sense? Maybe it does. Tell me how it makes sense. I kind of recoil at the idea, but maybe it makes sense. So tell me why.
Yeah, I think it's a good question, but I, again, have to turn to the case law on it, and that presumption doesn't change based on who's being involved. I think the way we handle this is going to be through legislation. I think you could change 19.59 to say, yeah, in any time that you are the ones who's sitting on your own decision, doesn't matter if it's legislative, doesn't matter if it's adjudicative, that is inappropriate. There's also other recourse. I mean, you could move to have that person recalled. There are electoral processes to prevent those situations, or if it doesn't make sense or if it feels unethical, there are other options to prevent that from happening. But I think it has to happen through legislation and not through the Constitution. And I think that's what the case law, I think that's where the case law points us.
Counsel, you were saying, well, there's no evidence here, but your argument doesn't depend on that. Your argument is it doesn't matter whether there's evidence because there is simply no due process right here, right?
Correct.
Right. And what you're saying is that if this is something we don't want to happen, then laws should be passed that say it shouldn't happen, and it's not a constitutional matter.
That's correct. Do you want me to expand?
Well, I when you started talking about County of Dane and Miller and presumptions, then struck me as we're getting into the world of whether this particular case shows evidence of bias. And I thought your argument was it doesn't matter because the due process right doesn't apply to a legislative decision like this. And so that's why I found it you drifting into that in response to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley in her questions. I was trying to figure out how those fit with your argument.
Sure. That is our front argument, that it's legislative, there is no due process right, and that's exactly why I was answering this is a legislative issue, because the Constitution isn't going to address. So that I guess that's what I was trying to convey. I am alternatively arguing that you could maybe assume away that issue and get to the facts of this case, and I think we still win on that. So,
if we did that, I noticed your argument on page 17 about the record. And so is there's no documentation of this relationship between Trustee Miller they're all Miller. but the fact that Miller lived with Whaley, like, that's not in the record?
That is not in the record. So when you look through, I think the closest I've come to in the record, so it's not explicitly stated. I think even looking at the reply brief, that is conceded, that it's not explicitly stated. All we know is that there's an ethics issue and that people were upset about her ethics. And when I read, so this is record item, I'm on appendix page 187, and this is the municipal attorney giving advice about whether it is ethical or not for her to sit on this decision. His opinion, and I'm quoting, "Trustee Miller does not have a conflict of interest as she does not receive nor will be receiving any monetary values from rezoning of the property in question." And they cite 1946, but I think we've all kind of agreed at this point that they really meant 1959. They're almost identical in the relevant provisions. To me, that 1959 has three components. The first is you can't benefit yourself. The second, you can't benefit a family member. And the third is that you can't benefit an organization. If I was reading this just without knowing any of the facts, if I was behind the veil of ignorance here, that looks like all the ethics concern was that she would be benefiting herself. That's the most I can infer from this record. I get it.
What page is that?
That's on page 187 of the appendix. And it's not like they weren't.
I'm just not seeing it there. Is it the regular board meeting minutes?
Yeah, it should be the board meeting minutes.
Okay.
I can pull it up quick.
Yeah, no, we found it. Thank you.
Okay, excellent. And it's not like there wasn't an opportunity to get those facts in there. I mean, there are emails. There are. There's his appeal. There's his written documents in the record. So there was an opportunity for him to get those. I don't need to die on this hill. I understand this case becomes a lot less appealing and may not have been what you expected if this is the way we go, but I do think the court has to be mindful that this limitation is there for a reason. The certiorari record limitation, not really for the parties, it's for the court. It's a separation of powers principle, at least in my view, where we don't have state courts overruling municipal actions based on facts and based on arguments that weren't before them to basically reverse those decisions. And there's obviously a sandbagging concern where you could have somebody sitting on good facts or you know, their killer issue and then waiting for certiorari review if it turns out that the local government decision isn't what they thought it was going to be. So my position is that it's important for the court to go through. I'm not going to die on that hill. I think we win for all the several reasons on the due process question. So like I said, at the end of the day, what I'm going to ask is that this court hold what we said in, or what you all said in Quinn, which is a local legislative body, when it votes to amend its zoning ordinance, that's a legislative choice. That for the there is no constitutional basis for someone to just point at kinship and claim that is evidence of bias, and that the village board's decision should be affirmed, not the village's. Again, I don't have strong feelings about what this court does with the lower court decision, the Court of Appeals, but I just want to make sure that if we are going that direction, that it's very clear that all lower court decisions, the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, and the ZBA's decision are not valid. So there's no confusion about which opinion is the controlling opinion below. So if there aren't any more questions, I will cede the remainder of my time to the court. Thank you.
Yes, in intervener's reliance on the Quinn case, I would like to point out that Quinn is about a person trying to put in an ice cream parlor and get the land rezoned, and he had to get a town and a county to each rezone the property. The main thrust of the case is discussing the interplay between towns and counties, each having veto power over whether each has veto power over the other's rezoning. And it was, the court found it was constitutional for the town to have veto power over the county. The court does make a statement in dictum that an action does not lose its legislative character because the number of people affected or size of the land is small. This statement was not the central holding. This opinion was written 8 years before Maris, and Maris found no problem with it when discussing that when stating that actions can be quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial. This Quinn statement is an overly simplistic generalization that doesn't even acknowledge spot zoning, which Wisconsin courts had dealt with. If this court believes the Quinn statement should be distinguished or overruled, then it should do so based on better authorities, such as the McQuillan statement that I've quoted, where McQuillan, in his treatise, says, proceedings or acts that scrutinize individual parcels for the consideration of property-specific proposed uses at the owner's or developer's initiative suggest a quasi-judicial process or act. These types of individualized determinations are distinguishable from acts that have broader community-wide implications, which encompass the entire planning district. And this was not a community-wide consideration. This came from an owner's initiative. And furthermore, when they claim that Miller did not have a property interest, the statements in the record show that he owns three rental properties and the general store, all within 0.2 of a mile of the property being rezoned. And for an example, I challenge somebody whose neighbor is going to put in a landfill to sit by and say, I have no due process right to go and fight this landfill under rezoning. My property interests don't count. Only the landfill owner's property counts. Of course, your property is affected by what comes in next to you and within 0.2 of a mile. That's just obvious. And furthermore, let me read one more quote. I've got another minute. In saying that we had to put in statements that the mother shows she will be biased, there's no law saying that. There's a well-known phrase, a mother's love knows no bounds. This mother lives in the same small village with her daughter and her daughter's husband in their same house.
Is that in the record?
Yes, it is.
Where is that in the record?
It's in Miller. It's in the complaint, the amended complaint, and the answer.
You're talking about to the circuit court.
Yes.
Okay. That's not
so
the record.
So in the record, the record statements.
The record is what came in front of the board.
It was common knowledge in the village that she's the mother. So I did all the objections where it says that...
Common knowledge is not in something in the record. Can you point to something in the village board?
In the reply brief on page 11, I listed the places where it shows that people complained at the hearings that Ms. Miller should not be allowed to vote. And the attorney explained that under the state statute, she wouldn't be excluded. The statute deals with family members. He wouldn't be citing a family member statute if the family member situation were not obvious.
So inferences are what you want us to draw instead of facts.
Well, then there is next to speak was Heidi questioning the ethics of Trustee Jan Miller. That's in the record. They offered no other explanation for why people were upset with her voting. And it was common knowledge that she was the mother. Then in the audio tape, Ms. Miller can be heard saying, the Whaleys don't support me, I don't support them. So you can't hear the woman who's complaining to her first and why she's making this reply. But yes, it is inference that everyone in the village knew she was the mother and they're upset by this. And they were upset from the beginning and they complained from the beginning about it. And nobody's offered any other explanation. But if you're trying to say that Mr. Miller had to get up and say on the record, you're her mother, you can't vote, well, that's asking a lot of village people who all know this. There's no requirement in law that everyone's going to remember to put this into a statement when it's so obvious to them. They just say, you shouldn't be allowed to vote. And my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you for interesting oral argument. The court is adjourned. We'll reconvene and close conference at 1:30.